Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Dolores Handy. Tonight, we present the first of three installments from the annual lecture series, The Fascination with Jewish Tales, by teacher, author, and Nobel Peace Prize winner, Elie Wiesel. Tonight's lecture is titled, A Portrait of the Messiah. We begin with an introduction by Boston University School of Medicine Dean and Medical Campus Provost, Dr. Karen Antman.
It's a privilege to introduce our speaker tonight. Many of you are very familiar with his work from the events of his life from reading his books that he's authored. Elie Wiesel was born September 30th, 1928, in a section of Romania annexed to Hungary between 1940 and 1945. In 1944, at age 15, he and his family were deported to Auschwitz, where his mother and younger sister died. Wiesel and his family were part of the forced march to Buchenwald, where his father died before the camp was liberated in April of 1945. He was reunited with his two older sisters in France after the war. He began his philosophy studies at the Sorbonne in 1948 and subsequently became a journalist for French and Israeli newspapers. He was then interviewed by Moriak, the 1952 Nobel laureate in literature, who convinced him to write about his experiences in the concentration camps. That account, Night in English, was first published in 1956 in Yiddish and in 1958 in French, and was eventually translated to more than 30 languages. A recent translation in 2006 by Marion Wiesel was selected by the Oprah Winfrey Book Club recently. His more than 50 subsequent books have won numerous awards. His academic career began in New York City. In New York City, he moved to New York in 1955 as a journalist, as a foreign correspondent, becoming a naturalized U.S. citizen in 1963. He became the distinguished professor of the City University of New York from 1972 to 1976. Since 1976, he's been the Andrew Mellon Professor of the Humanities at Boston University. He also holds the title of University Professor and has faculty appointments in both religion and philosophy. He was elected to the Academy of Arts and Letters in 1996. And in 1986, he received the Nobel Peace Prize. The Norwegian Committee called him a messenger to mankind via his own personal experience of total humiliation and the utter contempt for humanity shown in Hitler's death camps, as well as his practical work in the cause of peace, Wiesel has provided peace, atonement, and human dignity. Wiesel has defended causes in Israel, Soviet Jews, Nicaragua's Mosquito Indians, Argentina's disappeared, Cambodian refugees, the Kurds, and victims of South African apartheid, African famine, and the war in the former Yugoslavia. Just last month, September 14th, he appeared before the UN Security Council to call attention to the humanitarian crisis in Darfur. A few quotes resonate particularly during these times, ones that are my personal favorites. Always question those who are certain of what they're saying. Or, take sides. Neutrality helps the oppressor, never the victim. Silence encourages the tormentor, never the tormented. But perhaps the most relevant quote for tonight's lecture is the quote, God made man because he loves stories. The theme of Professor Wiesel's October lectures this year, and there'll be three, are the fascination with Jewish tales. Tonight's lecture is entitled A Portrait of the Messiah. Ladies and gentlemen, Professor Wiesel.
A man, a name, an idea perhaps, or is it an utopic desire, a dream, a prayer? We cannot tell. Those who speak do not know. and those who know don't speak. Shrouded in mystery, everything about the Messiah is secret and forbidden ground. To come close to his domain is dangerous. Try to open the gates to his palace, and you place your sanity and your life in jeopardy. And yet, his hold over our destiny is strong and stubborn. A childhood memory for the dying old man. A friendly presence for the abandoned. A light beckoning in the distance for the weary wanderer. The Son of David, the Anointed One, has been man's constant reminder that time is not necessarily his implacable enemy. True, the future contains fear, but then fear at the end serves as vehicle for hope. The Messiah, supreme mutation of words and deeds, the meaning of meanings, epitome of human sorrow and consolation, an obsession as ancient as exile, a remedy to exile. Remove him from Judaism and you lose the most exalted and needed of its dreams. The most poignant tales are about his coming. The saddest laments tell of his being late. The Messiah, Israel's answer to tragedy. He symbolizes our preoccupation with time instead of space, with history rather than geography. What is he if not the memory of the future? Stressing beginnings rather than ends, he adds another dimension to man's life which would otherwise unfold fatalistically, moving from despair to despair. The Messiah, melody of language and silence, justification of silence, in silence, invoke his name and simple words gain poetic intensity. Listen to his call and all your gestures become significant. But why the Messiah in the first place? Why was he called upon to enter Jewish imagination and Jewish belief only to haunt them forever? What made him a symbol of our endurance, a bearer of our promise? Is he meant to stress man's inherent weakness and remind us that alone man would be incapable of redeeming or even helping himself? Or, on the contrary, is he but an illustration of man's strength and glory, since the Messiah himself will be human after all? Granted, he will be or is already perfect, but still humanly perfect or perfectly human. Is he then meant to emphasize the fact that he and he alone can combine humaneness and perfection? Is he the ideal man we shall never be? So what is our relationship to him? What do we have in common now, not in the distant future? Does he suggest only the beyond and nothing else? If so, if the Messiah will have us wait for him forever, if waiting for the Messiah will remain the constant element of Jewish messianism, why must we see in him cause for rejoicing and not despair? How are we to wait for someone who is destined to be late? Remember the great Hasidic master Rabbi Moshe of Uihei. On Yom Kippur Eve, the holiest day and holiest night of the year, before the solemn prayer of Kol Nidre, this is how he spoke to God. Master of the universe, my strength is gone. I am exhausted. You must send us the Messiah. If you have no choice, neither have we. I am not asking for my own salvation. If you wish, I am ready to deny myself a single ray of light, a single tear of joy. I know, Master of the Universe, I know as you do that I am the last of the last. But I do love truth, and I feel I must say publicly, if I had known that my hair would turn white without my eyes ever beholding the Redeemer of Israel, I could not have gone on living. But you held me. You kept me going with hope, with faith. You procrastinated day after day, hour after hour, prayer after prayer. You fooled me. Not telling me, God of Abraham, God of Isaac, God of Jacob. Is it really so clever, so charitable, so nice to mock an old man like me, an old fool like me? Really, God Almighty, I ask you, is it just to make fun of me? Another time, another place, somewhere in the darkest of kingdoms, an ageless, faceless Kabbalist gathered the last of his disciples around him. And together they decided to wait no longer, for the end was near. God himself has led his chosen people to the altar. And should the Messiah really be late, this time it would be too late. They knew what to do, what to say and when, what words to use, what names to invoke. And because they were spokesmen for their slaughtered people, they nearly succeeded. Beyond the walls surrounding them, beyond the heavy silence, they perceived the upheaval in heaven. Victory was within their reach. The gates were about to open, and soon death would be vanquished. And suddenly, one of the conspirators shook his head and whispered, "No, we must not force God's hand. Why bring the Messiah into our forbidden cities? Why inflict such suffering on him? Why?" And yet, if ever there was a time when he should have intervened on behalf of his people and the whole world, it was then. "The Messiah will come," says the Talmud, "when mankind will be either totally just or totally guilty." Any possible condition? No. For the saying has another meaning. There will be a time when mankind will be divided, polarized. On one side, the just. On the other, the guilty, with no place for neutrals, for neutrals are accomplices and they too are guilty. And well, we have known such a time. On the one side, the killers, on the other, the victims. What happened to the Messiah? Why hasn't he come? Where was he? As in years past, we shall study together. We shall explore legends rather than theories, people instead of doctrines. In retelling stories about messianic figures, we aim not to display erudition or to reveal mysteries, but simply to illuminate the beauty and the grace woven into their fabric. We shall concentrate on the Jewish Messiah. I speak as a Jew, and I speak with respect, I hope you understand and you know, with respect towards all those who are not Jewish and who believe in what they believe in. I believe that we are here to create more bonds, more links, to bring people closer to one another rather than separate one from another. And if any word of mine could, I hope not, create some anguish or anxiety, I apologize. I don't mean that. I really believe that we are here to live together and wait together, you know, old story, together, wait for the Messiah. For the Jew and perhaps for everyone else, really I believe that no theme seems more urgent or more relevant. If man's life depends on God, his position in life is guided towards the Messiah. Ultimately, it is the Messiah, knowingly or not on our part. It is he who governs our individual and collective aspirations and confers upon them their weight of mystery, their faith and its melody. What was communism if not messianism without God? And thus it is to a pilgrimage to the very source of hope, of messianic hope, that I wish to invite you tonight. In the beginning, the messianic idea was essentially Jewish, with strong nationalistic connotations. God, and later the Son of David, would end Israel's exile and restore its splendor and sovereignty. Then the notion was enlarged and transformed so as to encompass man and transcend him or her, with a personal redeemer waiting to abolish all conflicts and erase all evil everywhere. That the very notion of redemption, personal and universal alike, originated in Judaism has not been seriously disputed. Like monotheism, the Messiah has been our contribution, our gift to history. Obviously, with the passing of generations, the idea appealed to other cultures and religions and was adopted and adapted by and to their structures and needs. Mythical figures of messianic heroes, brave leaders or divine messengers have helped many tribes, many groups overcome adversity, poverty, or humiliation. To forget the misery of everyday life, they would dream of a better time to come. But this is no longer messianism as we understand it. Jewish messianism opposes escapism. On the contrary, it implies active participation. In Buddhism and Stoicism, redemption means to free oneself from the world. In Judaism, it inserts man into the world, into reality. It implies no negation of time, no withdrawal of life, but a celebration of both. No nirvana, no satori, but justice and compassion and humanity and freedom, freedom above all. The opposite of the true Messiah, which we call Mashiach HaMet, is not a false Messiah. It's something else. The opposite really is the unjust Messiah. And we speak of the true Messiah, we believe, Mashiach Tzidkenu, the Messiah of justice, the one who increases justice in the world. And therefore, we believe that rather than ignore the present, man is asked to assume it, to seize the fleeting instant and bring it to fruition and fulfillment. Not indifferent to his or her surroundings, Jewish messianism attempts to sharpen their sensitivity, heighten their awareness. Hence the basic differences between Jewish messianism and others. To Christians, the Messiah is God's link to man, while in Judaism, man is God's link to the Messiah. But who is he? Who is this person whose mission is the most crucial in history? Who is the Messiah? Surely you will not be surprised to hear that this question too, like many others about him, will remain unanswered. Nothing about the Messiah will be known, says Maimonides, until he comes. And then we will know everything else. The Bible and the Talmud are full of descriptive and informative details about Abraham and Moses, Cain and Abel, and even Job, whose very existence remains in doubt. We are given vivid portraits of and vital statistics for all of them, not for the Messiah. His personal file is strangely empty, totally absent from Scripture, and only barely present in hints in the prophets. But he does emerge more clearly in Talmudic and Midrashic literature. But even there, only in profile. Poetry replaces facts. Much as messianic times occupy the imagination of our marvelous storytellers, the messianic person and personality remain suspiciously in the shadow. Where does he come from? Who are his friends and companions? Was he married? What is his occupation, his vocation, his temperament, his nature? Did he choose to become Redeemer? Is there a school of Redeemers? Has he been a member there? Is he aware of that school, of his mission? What are the qualities, the virtues, the accomplishments that make him the personification of the most exalting and highest human ambitions? We are told that he is of the line of David, or Ephraim, or Joseph, but not much else. In fact, many sources offer elements of information designed only to confuse and mislead the reader. Some texts, some legends were written for the sole purpose of preventing us from seeing him as he is, surrounding him with yet another wall of imperceptible reality or super-reality. To establish his file, we must begin with his name. And right away we run into trouble. We are told that his name was created before the creation of the world, and nobody knows what it is. The idea, though poetic, seems deliberately vague. If his name is older than the world, is the same true of him as well? Does it mean that unlike his name, he, the bearer of the name, is a part of man's world? That he, unlike his name, belongs to our perception of reality? Does it change with us? His tale may be the tale of a name in search of a person, one as elusive as the other. The Talmud tells us that at the school of Rabbi Shiloh, it was believed that his name is or should be Shiloh. But at the academy of Rabbi Yanai, it was assumed that his name would be Yinon, which comes from Yanai. As for the disciples of Rabbi Hanina, they naturally claimed that his name is Hanina. Should we dismiss this anecdote as a simple exercise in courtesy and school loyalty? Were these different names nothing but compliments paid by students to their respective teachers? True, in those days, students were respectful. But I don't believe that they indulge in such gross flattery. What then is the meaning of the parable? First, it stresses the importance of names in our tradition. The Messiah has a name, an identity linked to ours. Secondly, that he will have to be a scholar, not a politician. Thirdly, that he may have more than one name. And also, that any student, any pupil, any person, any one of us, is allowed to guess that the name is whatever. Not who he is, but what his name will be. And finally, that until the coming of the Messiah, no one theory will be more valid than another. The real name, like its bearer, must remain unknown. One of the most beautiful, I think, customs, if not traditions about that, about the Messiah, is that when I see a pregnant woman, I should get up and give her my seat in the bus or anywhere. I must respect. Why? Because she is pregnant? She's a woman, surely. But no, because maybe she has the Messiah in her womb. My God, really. How can you resist such a... But are you sure that the Messiah is... Well, listen to a story which some of you know. A Jewish student, pious and intelligent, was recently stopped by a member of the Lubavitch Mitzvah Mobile next Columbia University. The Lubavitch is Chabad. They have their own mitzvah trucks, and they stop people. Are you Jewish? Yes, she said proudly. Then the student said, the Lubavitcher said, here are some candles for Sabbath. Why do you give me candles, she said, and not a phylacterist, tefillin? Because, he said, you are a girl. Girls do not put on tefillin, only boys do. Her retort came quickly. But in Messianic times, we are told, all mitzvot, all commandments will be applied equally to both men and women. Hasn't you, Rabbi of blessed memory, said that we live in Messianic times? The argument was so powerful that the poor Hasid was embarrassed. He said nothing. So the girl walked away. Suddenly he ran after her. He said, all right, you win. Tell me, you believe in the Messiah? She said, yes. When is he coming? And she snapped back, he? She? You may tell any story about him as long as it's about him or her, it's okay. At first, the term Messiah, the anointed one, applied to kings and priests, elected and anointed by God, Saul, David, even King Cyrus of Persia. The adjective, the function became name only after the exile. But then, let's continue. His parents, who are they? Where do they come from? What is their share in his mission, in his glory? What have they done to deserve such distinction? Can't you hear a nice Jewish mother boasting, ah, my son, the Messiah? Their names, too, are subjects to controversy. Is the father's name Amiel, according to some sources, or Chizkiyahu? Both are mentioned. And more, only to make it impossible to formulate any plausible answer with any reasonable certainty, only to add to our bewilderment. The same is true of his birthplace. One source indicates Jerusalem, another Bethlehem, a third situates somewhere in the Galilee. In one legend, the event is announced by an Arab to a Jewish laborer who immediately interrupts his work and sets out to search for the Redeemer. In another, a celestial voice, by its very nature more cryptic, explains to a Jewish farmer why his cow cried before it mooed with contentment. And from this, the Jew, evidently intelligent, understood that sadness precedes happiness, tragedy precedes redemption, and so redemption is near. In a third legend, the prophet Elijah himself hears the voice and sets out to find the Messiah. The three legends differ even more when the newly born Savior is finally located. The first Jew is told by the baby's mother that winds and tempests have swept her son into the unknown. The second Jew does meet the child and visits him year after year until one day he no longer finds him. The child vanished and became the Messiah. As for prophet Elijah, he witnesses his disappearance. He is there on the spot when it happens. He sees with his own eyes the child being kidnapped and taken to the vast ocean. All these legends have one point in common: the day of birth. Most, though not all commentators believe that he was born on the day the temple was destroyed, which perhaps means that Jewish tragedy is intrinsically linked to Jewish salvation. For Jewish history unfolds according to a certain rhythm, a preordained movement, and the last word will not be the executioners but God's. Thus, the blackest day in our recorded history marks the beginning of a new era. Or as one source puts it, the notion of liberation preceded that of oppression. The Messiah will forever appear, when and where hope is most needed, on the ruins of Jerusalem. His link to the ninth day of Av has another reason too. He wants to participate in all our experiences as he wishes us to remember the destruction too. There is another point on which there seems to be unanimity in all the sources: the unhappiness of the child's mother, who is not depicted as a saint at all. Most stress her sadness, her bitterness. Some insinuate that she hates her son, that she curses him for being born on such a dark day. She neglects him. She refuses to wash him, to dress him, to take care of him. Her attitude changes only when she discovers that her son's birthday was chosen by God himself and that he is going to become somebody important and famous. For everything else about the mother or the father, we are in the dark, or to use a Talmudic expression, teku. Next item, place of residence. Where is the Messiah to be found? Where does he stay while waiting for the call? Here too we have l'embarras du choix. The possibilities are endless. A legend. One day, Rabbi Yeshua, son of Levi, met the prophet Elijah at the entrance of Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai's cave. So naturally, he took advantage of the occasion to ask him the most burning of questions. When will he come? Why ask me, says the prophet. Ask him. But where is he? Where can I find him? I'll tell you, said the prophet. Go to the gates of city, and take some sources, the gates of Rome, and there you will see many beggars. He's one of them. How will I be able to identify him? I'll tell you, said the prophet. Some of the beggars are sick, covered with wounds. He's one of them. But if there are many, how will I recognize him? I'll tell you, said the prophet. The sick beggars untie their bandages all at once and then bind them up again. He, the Messiah, looks at one and bandages one wound at a time, for fear that he may be summoned and he must not be late. Another text. Paradise is surrounded by three walls of fire, says the mystical literature. The first area is for the just man among the Gentiles. The second is for all those waiting for the Messiah who dwells within the third wall, in a sanctuary named the Nest of the Bird. From the outside, the Messiah can be seen only once a day, except on the eve of Sabbath, when he leaves his dwelling place and ascends into a much higher sanctuary, built with letters that move constantly, composing words and names, without ever making a mistake. At one point they stop, appeased, and then comes the Sabbath, the Shabbat of Shabbat, the Sabbath of Sabbaths, and a profound joy reigns in the palace, penetrating all those present. Then a gate opens, and the Messiah with his entourage enters still another sanctuary, and there they find themselves face to face with the holy martyrs of the faith. They have the most exalted place in that palace. And the Messiah, overcome by sadness, begins to cry and to shout so loud that the very foundations of the universe tremble and all the heavens are shaken and they begin to turn and turn and everything turns with them. And God, the master of the universe, moves, finally sheds two tears over his creation. There are many other legends about his dwelling place. All are told for the sole purpose of not disclosing exactly where it is. Is it in heaven? Among the angels? On earth, perhaps? Among us, with the mortals? We have no choice but dutifully record our inability to complete the questionnaire. Place of residence? Unknown. So is his age? Unknown. Occupation? Unknown. Or rather, present occupation unknown. Later, after redemption, we know what he will be. You won't believe it. He will be a teacher. And the tzaddikim, the just people, will study Torah under him, with him. Suddenly we realize that the most exalting seminar in the world is actually anywhere where he is, and he may be anywhere. Perhaps, therefore, we should say that the Messiah represents the triumph of our imagination. And yet we are offered a profusion of details, all strikingly descriptive, not about the Messiah, but about his arch enemy. His name is Armillus, king and emperor, cruel and bloodthirsty. He seems abnormal, and he is. His hair is red, and his face is green. And if that isn't enough to frighten you, there is more. He has six fingers on each hand, one very big eye and another very small, a boil on his forehead and a blocked right ear. He was 100 years old when he was born, of strange parents. His father was Satan, or one of his emissaries, and his mother a statue representing the most beautiful woman in the world, as old as creation itself. Legend has it that this statue still exists and nobody can resist her. Armillus is her son. He's heartless because his heart is of stone. He is incapable of any human feeling. What he wants is to enslave men and rule them by terror. His ultimate ambition, to be crowned Messiah by and for the entire world, and especially Israel. But according to legend, Israel refused. Israel did not, could not believe in a savior without a heart. Rather die than worship him. Rather perish than praise him. So Armillus long ago began to exterminate Jews. And lo and behold, they chose to resist. They fought, and they fought well. So fell that the Messiah appeared, the real Messiah, and led them into battle, with the Messiah as commander-in-chief. The Jews inflicted heavy losses on Armillus. Unfortunately, the time was not ripe yet. The Messiah fell as a hero on the battlefield. Was this the end? No. The Jews lost a commander, but not hope. The Messiah has come, they said, and he has fallen. He was a true Messiah, but not the only one. We have two Messiahs. One is the son of Joseph, and he had to die. and died tragically to pave the way for the next one, the son of David, who will not die, not ever. He will appear after the battle, and though invincible, he will not be a soldier. He will kill death. Death will die when the Messiah will come. So in other words, to confuse us even more, the character of the Redeemer was split in two, as though things weren't complicated enough with one. Here we are with two on our hands. One as desperately alone as the other, but death or alive, the true Messiah defies language. There can be no portrait of either the son of Joseph or the son of David. Should we see one, we may reject him and state either the portrait or the model is false. The Messiah lives in man, at the deepest level of his being, forever, inaccessible to the eye, forever ineffable, and therefore incorruptible. I believe in messianic moments. And these moments are spread like the sparks in mystical literature. Every person has a spark, a moment, a messianic moment. But then we should know that in our tradition, attention is mainly focused on the messianic age, on the messianic era. In the more than one the person, it is the era that intrigued our sages. The era itself is divided into the waiting and the advent. The advent has fascinated legislators, codifiers, and philosophers of law. The waiting has inspired poets, dreamers, and philosophers of history. Sogt der Rebbe, was wird sein, wenn Mashiach wird kommen, asked the popular Yiddish tune. Tell us, teacher, what will happen when the Messiah will come? What will the practical effects of the mystical metamorphosis be? And we say all kinds of things. Of course, the Shekhinah will be reunited. Of course, the holy sparks will rejoin the flame. Of course, people will become so good to one another. But practically, will the baker have to abandon his trade? For bread will grow on trees. Will the tailors and the dressmakers have to apply for unemployment, since the customers will get everything ready-made and free? Will the messianic age be one of utopia alone? Most commentators agree that on the Jewish level, the new era will be translated in terms of national renaissance. The remnants of Israel will be ingathered from faraway exiles, freed from somber and stifling dungeons. No longer will our people be subjected to the hard laws of foreign nations. They will live and be happy and in peace with its neighbors and sovereign, masters of their own destiny. The liberator will be a national liberator first. This prophetic view has been so frequently emphasized by so many early sources that one sage made it exclusive of everything else, said Shmuel. The difference between the messianic age and now will simply be that our people will have regained its independence. And then what? Will there be a temple? Will all its rituals, sacrifices, and offerings be reinstated? What about the prayers that replace them? What about the holidays? What about the waiting? Will we stop waiting, which is so beautiful? One source suggests that of all the prayers, and we have so many, only one will remain. And I love it, the prayer of gratitude. I truly believe that a person or a community can be defined by their ability to say thank you. And I love it that when Messiah will come, we will say simply, thank you. Later sources enlarge the messianic event so as to include all of mankind. The end of times will bring purification, a mutation of man. A new order will replace the old, eliminating cruelty and suffering. All masks will disappear. All illusions will dissolve. Nothing will be as before. Logic will be disarmed. The possible will be realized. The impossible too. Peace, harmony, love. It will be the end of fear, the death of death. And this metamorphosis will occur on all levels of human endeavor. All coercion will be broken. All instinct rechanneled. Wolves and sheep will live together, as will panthers and deer. Wild beasts and their hunters will become good friends. For man's heart will become soul. All men will be saints because they will be more human and wise. No more envy, no more jealousy, hate, remorse, anxiety, rancor. No more memory of a lost past. Israel will no longer be required to retell the story of its liberation from Egyptian bondage. All periods, all beings will be reconciled to one another and to themselves. The world, an immense dwelling place full of sunshine and the light of the Messiah. A society ruled by friendship. With the Messiah as king, the universe will become paradise once more. Time will be suspended forever, forgotten all mistakes and sins. Pushed aside all temptations. Man will do nothing but study Torah with the Messiah as Hoshe Shiva, the head of the academy. No more separation between creator and creation, God and man, dream and reality, words and meaning. Everything will be in everything and vice versa. Everything will be one, and one reflects perfection, perfect serenity, perfect truth, perfect joy, perfect knowledge, perfect self-knowledge. What a vision! One that grew out of Jewish experience and was shaped in the Jewish tradition. We needed it desperately. We needed to humanize time by transcending it. We needed to humanize destiny. We needed to humanize the human being around us and in us. But later came, at the end of many dreams, many laments, we still believe that one must believe in the Messiah, Messiah and Messianic time, feverishly, fervently, with force and passion. One must wait actively, creatively, for the waiting itself is part of the Messianic dream. A Jew can best be defined by his or her waiting, and their enemies know that. Waiting for the Messiah during the Inquisition in Spain and Portugal was a serious sin, punishable by death, and yet we are still waiting. Waiting for the Messiah, waiting for the somber events that must precede his revelation, that is the other aspect of the Messianic story. Rooted in catastrophes, the Messianic vision pushes them to their breaking point and beyond. For just as punishment implies sin, redemption suggests exile. In order to attain the fullest redemption, mankind must go through the darkest suffering. From inside darkness, one sees light, says the Zohar, the Book of Splendor. The thicker the night, the greater the flame. Only when night seems opaque and irrevocably sealed can Messianic dawn truly break. And the final stage is called Achrit Hayamim, the end of times, the eschatology or teleology, a kind of demarcation line between total exile and total redemption. The kingdom of man and domain of heaven is a time of the apocalypse, the shake-up of all that breathes, all that exists, the chaos that precedes the great cleavage, the eschatological exhaustion of evil in its last convulsions, the last shudder of the beast, the last outcries of the last demon in man, his last dance inside the halls of illusion and deceit, anguish in its raw state, naked, howling, demented fear, its last triumph before the crushing defeat. Popular imagery shows a wealth of fantasy and color in the Apocrypha, but the Apocrypha was not canonized, for it offers no hope whatsoever. No one could survive the horrors of the end of times. Even to welcome the Messiah, it's impossible. And therefore the texts are somber and beautiful. But hold out and hold on, for the expectations are there. When those times will come, we are told, the world will be plunged into the most murderous of wars. Society in disintegration will taste ashes, hunger, pogroms, savage and senseless killings. The earth will be covered with shame and blood. All the biblical maledictions will befall mankind, Gog and Magog, the climax of stark brutality. Regimes will stumble, nations will slaughter one another for no reason. An earthquake of such magnitude of evil will provoke a timequake of equal magnitude. Our Midrashic, mystical and Hasidic storytellers let their imagination go wild. Madness, they say, will invade mankind. The generation will consist of heretics, insolents, degenerates, ignorants, and criminals. the generation that will precede the generation of the Messiah. Quote, vanity and insolence will reign supreme. Schools will harbor prostitutes and their clients. Truth will be absent. Adolescents will insult their elders. Sons will throw obscenities at the face of their parents. Pupils will intimidate their masters. Listen to a description by Baruch HaSuri in the Apocrypha. And disorder and fear will reign over mankind. People will hate and kill one another. The wretched will rule over the powerful, the wicked over the heroes, the imbeciles over the wise, and he who will be spared from war will die in earthquake. He who will survive the earthquake will perish in fire, and he who will survive fire will die of hunger. Listen to Ezra the Fourth, his prediction. The sun will shine at midnight, and the moon during the day. Blood will drip from wood, and stones will speak. People shall be troubled and the stars shall fall. Nations will be in turmoil and beloved ones will fight enemies. These will be the times of total dehumanization. So much so that one Talmudic sage, Rabbi, exclaimed, I know the Messiah will come. I hope he will come, but I don't want to be around when he comes. For it will be the darkest moment in history. The world will be in the grips of impure forces, and woe unto him, her, who will be alive then. And I must tell you, I was convinced, believe me, in 1945, I thought that the only answer to what happened should be the coming of the Messiah. I, as then, was still so religious and so profoundly believing in Messianic coming. I said, that is the time. Because all that I just said happened then, in those times. In the Hasidic tradition, it's beautiful. They are poetic. The Rishonim said, with the dawning of the Messianic era, good and evil will go hand in hand and become one. Light will become indistinguishable from darkness. Daybreak from dusk, silence from words, words from truth, truth from fear, and fear from death. A day will come, he said, when all nations will begin hating Jews. They will hate them so much with such violence that the Jews will have no choice but to go to the land of their ancestors. And then, he said, woe unto us and woe unto them. It will be the beginning of redemption. He also said, a day will come when man will stop hating others and begin hating himself. When all things will lose their coherence and there will be no relation between man and his face, desire and its object. There will be no relation between question and its answer, between parable and its meaning. But afterwards, of course, we are told that all this will happen. It will only be a prelude to real redemption. And so what must one do? Wait for it passively? Of course not. It must not wait passively. Waiting must be creative and imaginative. One of the first questions put to man or woman in the other world will be, have you been waiting for redemption? Which means, have you really consciously been waiting for the Messiah? With all your heart and soul, with every fiber of your being. For in this context, waiting takes on a significance both religious and concrete. Its very outcome depends on it. In other words, it's up to us to shorten or lengthen exile. If our waiting is fervent enough, not only will exile end sooner, but redemption will occur earlier. And so, this is maybe the moral lesson of the story. We believe that only we, human beings, can bring the Messiah. It's not God who is sending him down. It's our work. And what is the work? The work is to be worthy of it. In spite of what we heard from the Apocrypha, which is the Apocrypha but not the canon, it's us, what we do to each other, which brings the Messiah closer. And we live now in a world which is, at the beginning of the century already, so deeply fraught with so much hatred and so much danger and so much suffering, that what can we do except try to tell each other what we must say, that unless we listen to the lesson, we listen to the message, and the message is the role of a human being is not to be a saint, but to be human. And if we are human, I mean human in its noblest sense, I believe that it is the other that determines my humanity. What I do to the other shows me and others what I am. And if we open ourselves to that idea that the other is as worthy of the Messiah that I am, that we are, maybe the story will not be a story of waiting in despair, but a story of extraordinary beauty, of hope, and nothing is more beautiful than to be able to possess that gift and share it with one another. Thank you.
You've just heard the first of three lectures in the annual series, The Fascination with Jewish Tales, by teacher, author, and Nobel Peace Prize winner Elie Wiesel. Tonight's lecture was titled A Portrait of the Messiah. Introducing Professor Wiesel was Boston University School of Medicine Dean and Medical Campus Provost Dr. Karen Antman. For a CD or cassette of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. CDs and cassettes are $15, which includes shipping and handling. Tonight's program was produced by Matt Odette and Tim Scove, with help from Mike Toda. Our web producer is Angel Cazelli. I'm Dolores Handy. Thanks for joining us.